Hi, I'm Georgette Pierre, and you're listening to Black and Nuance Podcast, dispelling the idea that Black people are monolithic. So where do I begin? I wanted to be all these different things when I was younger, but the root of what wanted to be birthed within me was storytelling, even though it took me some time to get there. I recall this baby photo of me behind the typewriter. I had to be between 6 to 8 years old, tops. Fast forward to high school where I was writing rhymes, poetry, and learning how to type over 70 words per minute. Yes, I know how to type over 70 words per minute. I go to college and was still writing rhymes, but also performing them. I dabbled in radio throughout undergrad and grad school before exploring the phenomenon of writing in a different way. I won't ever forget what Dee Simpson told me. One of my mentors in life and my former boss at Emerson College's WERS 88.9 FM, and now the general manager. He said, if you know how to write, then you can get a job anywhere. He didn't have to tell me twice. I wrote for the news department. I started blogging for the station when WordPress started emerging. I did some correspondent work for the now defunct Karma Loop TV in Boston, where I figured out how to write my own scripts just by listening to the tone and scripts of other correspondents. And then I moved to New York. It took me some time to get my footing, but when I did, I soared. Shout out to Killer Boombox, Brandon Matthews, aka Bizzle, and G Valentino Ball for allowing me to have the autonomy to do whatever the fuck I wanted for their platform. Writing for KBX, Killer Boombox, later landed me writing opportunities at MTV Rap Fix, now called MTV Hip Hop, which led me to writing for VH1, shout out Orlando, which led to getting poached by Entertainment Weekly. But I got tired of chasing after these pop culture stories. I wanted to do something bigger. Now, living in New York and working at Viacom at the same time really planted the seeds for me seeing the power of telling stories for the big screen. I just wanted to center more of our stories, Black stories, loudly and proudly for a living. I eventually met my next guest in 2014 in the La, my way of referring to LA, who does write for a living and share the catalyst that led him to pursuing writing full time from the jump.
I've been writing since I was like 7, and what led me to it is The Cosby Show, you know, and God, I always hate bringing up, you know, The Cosby, but so many good things came out of the show. And one of them was, you know, I was able to watch it and see that, hey, you know, like Rudy wrote a fairy tale. And I was like, I want to write fairy tales too. And I, you know, I started writing those, and then people read them. And I had teachers who like got behind me and would read the work and say, oh, there's something about this kid.
Well, there is something about Darnell Lamont Walker, but I'll let him introduce himself to the collective.
Almost nine years, I met Darnell.
A million.
In LA.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, through our friend Herbie, who said I stole you from him. But you came to New York for a bit. We were just hanging out.
And we was hanging out, and you know, you just click. You know, some people you just click with. I think actually it was probably that night at Herbie House, but... Also, New York kind of, you know, we used to walk the streets of New York. And
oh, man. Paint the city red.
I miss New York. I do miss New York. Dang, man.
Not to live here, but painting the city red. I definitely, yeah, you had us walking everywhere. I was like, Darnell, can we hop on somebody's train? Something. So, Darnell, I, you know, gave you a little bit of a zhuzh intro, but I always like my guests to introduce themselves on how they want to be heard and seen.
Right on. So I am Darnell Lamont Walker, the writer. And just, you know, I don't know. I just live my life. I eat a lot of food. I write a lot of things, talk to a lot of people, and just like to, you know, get to the happy parts of everything. And so I never know how to introduce myself. But yeah, I guess that's me. You know, it's like, I don't even know what I put in my bio, the official one that I send out to people, but you know, it says something about like TV shows that I worked on and places I worked. But mostly I just like to eat and be happy. So that's me.
That is you. Oh, come on now, friend. When I text you, you be wearing out Emmy nominated,
oh, yes.
Right? Come on.
You know, you got to say that. I say that for, you know, for the folks who can hire me. So if anyone who's listening is in a position to hire, I am Emmy nominated for the amazing show Karma's World, and hopefully for some shows this year. And so, you know. Add that to, you know, why you should hire me.
I love this shameless plug. And so, you know, with me wanting to get into there's so many nuances of being a storyteller, a filmmaker, an artist per se. And I think we definitely fall into that. And I know you lean heavy on the writer extraordinaire tip, because you really put your foot in writing in the stories that you tell, whether it's for children's television, whether it's your personal projects that are, you know, adult target audience, like adult leaning as far as target audience is concerned. So similar to comedians, writers and artists bear their soul in the work or the stories that they choose to tell. Mm-hmm. What led you to becoming a writer and an overall storyteller, Darnell?
One, I think that quote is so very true. It's a thing about like writing and just artists where we're always confessing, you know? Like I think in all of our work, there's always something about us in there. We pour so much of ourselves into it, even when we don't know we're doing it, but it's in there, which is why I love being a writer and I love being an artist, because it's like free therapy. But for me, I've been writing since I was like 7, and what led me to it is the Cosby Show, you know, and God, I always hate bringing up, you know, the Cosby now, but so many good things came out of the show. And one of them was, you know, I was able to watch it and see that, hey, you know, like Rudy wrote a fairy tale, and I was like, I want to write fairy tales too. And I, you know, I started writing those, and then people read them, and I had teachers who like got behind me and would read the work and say, oh, there's something about this kid. And I think, you know, you recognize when things like that happen. And so they really got behind me, my family, friends, and just kept pushing me, you know, and just, I kept moving through those doors all through school and through life. And so it just, one of those things I realized early that I did well, and I was good at it, and I enjoyed doing it, and I saw what it could do for the world, and I just wanted to do it. I wanted to be a part of that. And so, you know, that's how I ended up here, I guess.
I remember there was a story, and if you want to expand upon, I remember when, you know, you had your apartment, you were also talking about what you were also growing up around in Charlottesville, and it was either go the writer route or go a route where you don't know if you would have made it to 40.
Yeah, like, cause, you know, like I had grew up with cousins and friends who it's like everyone I know, you know, like all the Black folks I know, like we grew up in families that was kind of like, oh, this cousin sells drugs, this cousin does this. But, you know, again, what happens is you have those family members, even those family members who were outside, you know, 2 a.m., 3 a.m. selling drugs, they still saw something, and they find that person, and then they get behind that person. And so, you know, that's what it was for me. Like, I remember being outside and had a cousin who was like, oh, you can't be out here with us. You know, we need you. You going to college. Like, this is not the route you take.
Right.
And it's so funny because now I go, you know, go to family reunions, and they're like, yo, this the cousin I was telling you about. This the one. This nigga got an Emmy. You know, it's like, okay, yeah. Or Emmy nomination, you know, and it's like, cool, yeah, you know. It was absolutely that. Like, I think a lot of my friends who I grew up with went the other way, you know, family. And it was like, okay, but we'll get behind you and we'll push you. And that's what they did. And, you know, I really appreciate it. And it feels good to come home and be like, hey, yeah, well, thank you. I appreciate it, because what you did worked, you know, and you have to make it work. I think it was like, okay, if I don't make this work, at least I can go back and, you know, like, what do y'all say? How much baking soda goes into that? You said baking.
Not baking soda. Bacon. Let me pull up Snowfall. What they doing?
Yeah.
How many measuring cups do I need to have in my
Pyrex? Cool. and so, you know, listening to Jay-Z lyrics. But you know, you make it. And so it worked out. It worked out.
Yeah, no, it's interesting when there are moments or places and spaces people get to, whether when it was a choice of life or death or jail, you know. And so, okay, we know how you got to writing, but talk us through the journey of writing professionally, because I have worked with you on a soft level of when you would do your writer's rooms in your apartment, and you would call it Baldwin's room, right?
When Darnell had his apartment in the Bronx, he would literally build community by inviting people to workshop their ideas at the time. I didn't realize how important that kind of community would prove to be later on my journey to learn how to write professionally.
I come from the production side of TV. I know how to produce to an extent. And obviously there's things that I am still learning in my craft of producing. But writing professionally and hearing how you walk through these various stages of what is required of you seems taxing, sometimes seems daunting and unattainable for those of us like myself that are now transitioning into wanting to be a writing producer, a writer and producer. So talk us through the journey of writing professionally for those that may be interested or don't feel like they can do it, although it is attainable.
Yeah. And, but you know, that's the thing. Like, it always felt unattainable to me as well, but it was also something that I just couldn't stop doing. It was like, okay, I put so much into it. I starved for, you know, years in LA and in New York and DC. And so it for a while, it just seemed really unattainable. And then one day you look back and you're like, wow, I'm in this. And still, it just doesn't feel like I'm actually in this. But, you know, it was crazy because I did everything that every writer who goes to LA, every writer who goes to New York does. It's like we apply to all the workshops. We apply to all the fellowships. We apply. I mean, we meet up with our friends at 3 o'clock in the morning to go over scripts, and we exchange scripts, and we write specs, and we write originals, and they're mostly bad, and then sometimes they get good. And, you know, we do all of that. And you take all these meetings that become nothing. And, you know, one day I applied and said, you know, this is probably the 10th time, 15th time I've applied. And I probably won't get in, but got to make them say no, you know. And so I sent it in and got in. And it was the Sesame Workshop. Never thought about writing for kids, really professionally. And got in and realized, you know, day one in the program, like, this is where I'm supposed to be. Like, this is it. This is the thing I'm supposed to do. You know, and it's kind of like, I want to say the rest is kind of history, but it was still like, I did that for 2 months, got out of there, went to LA, and was back in that grind of how do you get in? But okay, now that I have all this knowledge and this name's kind of attached to me, the Sesame Street name that carries weight in a lot of areas, because we all know Sesame Street right. For the last, you know, what, 55 years or so. What do I do with it? And then it was like, okay. Now I had to think back to those hustling days and like those things that I did pick up from those friends and those families. Like, I've always been a hustler, you know, like whether it was drugs or getting into something else or whatever it was. But it was like, okay, how do I do that? Okay, we got to leverage some stuff. We got to talk to these people. We got to get in these rooms. And so then it was talking and leveraging and building relationships and, you know, using the gift of gab. And that led to a job with Blue's Clues in their writing room at the bottom as a script coordinator. And then went from there and just started getting jobs. I actually got hired to write my episode of Karma's World before I got the Blue's Clues job. So my first job in children's was writing. And then I became a script coordinator. And then, but the episode didn't come out for 3 years. And so it was like, okay, cool. Or 2.5 years. And but yeah, and you know, got in and just, and I'm still building those connections, building those networks, but it really became about, you gotta do it. Like, if writing is what you want to do, even through all these no's and all these meetings that really go nowhere, people in Hollywood, they love a meeting. And I don't know if they get paid to set these meetings, you would think they have to meet a quota, right? Because I so many, and you get so excited. You're like, yeah, you know, what'd you do today? Oh, you know, I was over at Sony. You know, they wanted to hear my idea. And then, like, 2 years go by, and people are like, whatever happened to Sony? Oh, you know, I never heard from them. Well, I don't know. And then you turn on the TV and you see your show on there, and you're like, oh, okay,
right.
But Sony didn't do that. That never happened with me. So just putting that out there. But you know, these things happen. But I really just grinded, and now I look back and it's like, wow. I really was starving, sitting on the couch, thinking about how hard it was to get into writing and how I would never do it. I really thought this would never happen, you know, and here we are. So
you mentioned script coordinator. What are like the 1 to 2 entry level positions that people that are like new into writing could at least feel like they can reach out to? Like what does a writer's PA do? Is that the same as a script coordinator? Like, what's the difference between those two positions?
Yeah. Those positions, I mean, like I tell folks who want to get into writing all the time, like so many, like even me, I was in Hollywood, people were like, you know, one, why'd you leave New York? Because there are a lot of jobs in New York. And then two, you need to look at script coordinator positions or writing coordinator positions, both the same. And so I was like, oh, no, I want to write. I don't want to do that. And so, you know, and this was a thing, but also me, like, I have no problem starting over. I just,
yeah,
if I don't have to, I won't. And then quickly realized that, oh, maybe I need to. And so, you know, you get in there and it's basically the editing, the, you know, gathering all the scripts and getting all the notes back from people, making sure that the freelance writers are on time, making sure the writers are on time with their scripts, making sure that, you know, these meetings happen when they're supposed to happen and everything stays on schedule as far as everything concerning writing. But then you have, you know, writing assistants that a lot of people will move into, and PAs, which basically are writing assistants, and sometimes script coordinators as well. They're all mixed in there somewhere. And it's just a great way in. And excuse me. And then if, especially if you're working with a great writer or a great writing team that knows what your goals are. And they know that you want to do what they're doing and they'll make sure that you get there. But I know people who got into these roles and were there for 3-4 years. I went in there and I was like, listen, I'm going to go in here and I'm going to learn as much as I can while hustling while I'm doing this. And so that way, when I am done with this, I am out and I'm going to something else. I did 2 seasons at Blue's Clues as a script coordinator, but also writing while I was there. For Blue's Clues, I finished my episode with Karma's World while in that job. I was able to write for Two What's in the Wild, a dope children's podcast, and some other podcasts. I got some other writing jobs that came through. And so it was like, you know, but leveraging that thing. Everyone doesn't have it, and I wish they did. Like, you know, I have friends who I was script coordinating with who are still script coordinators. That was what year is this? That was 4 years ago, 2019. So yeah, like, yeah, you know, so it's like, no, you know, you have to move. You got to go in, get what you need and then come out. And it's like, you know, so, but that's where you start. That I tell people, I know you want to be a writer. I know you want to go into it, but if you can do it and if you can hustle and if you can work it the right way, just go in there, get what you need and get out. And that's what I did. And
I like that.
That was great because, you know, as script coordinator, I had to talk to so many people. I had to basically be the liaison a lot of times between our show and the producers at the network that was putting it on, which was Nickelodeon at the time. And there are times now when I'll get a job and people are saying, oh, yeah, you know, I know you worked for so-and-so. They, you know, they told me that you were such a great person and they put a, you know, basically they didn't have to, but they put a word in for you. They kind of vouch for you. And it's like, yeah, yeah. I mean, I was over there. Yeah. I talked to those people too. Yeah. I worked with so-and-so. And so it was a great way for me to learn the names of the people in the industry, to learn more about it. And I think for me as a writer now, I'm a much stronger writer because I know the millions of notes that I got back on the scripts that other people were writing at that time. So when it was time for me to write my script, it was like, okay, let's go ahead and get this out. I know what to do. I know how to say it, blah, blah, blah.
Yes. Yeah, no, it's, I like that you nodded to not being afraid to start over again, because I know I struggled with that when I was on unemployment for almost a year. I literally just wanted to get back in television, working at some media company. And when a junior position came around at my old company, I was like, it will get me back in the building. Mm-hmm. It will get me in front of to network with. It will get me in certain spaces and places to continue connecting with other people. But sometimes ego gets in the way though.
Yeah.
Neezy, you know, ego gets in the way because you're just like, oh, I'm making half of what I made 2 years ago and 3 years ago. And it's just like, can I survive off of this? And it's sometimes a struggle or a challenge to hold on to the bigger picture and holding on to that, this journey being temporary.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, like, and that's what it is. It's, and then some people can't do that. Like I have friends who are in a job they hate, because they're like, I don't want to take that step. I don't feel like I should have to, I feel like I'm going backward. It's like, what? Like, this is what you want to do, though. Like, I did it for 2 seasons. And now, you know, I have an Emmy nomination. I have, you know, like, I think I've consistently been working, like, legitimately for like 3.5 years, you know what I mean? In writing, doing what I want to do.
Professionally, like getting paid professionally.
Getting
for
paid
it. Yeah.
To do it. Like, I am never without work because I was able to do that, because I took that step and was like, yeah, like I saw a meme a couple months ago. I think I posted it that was like, everybody's, all y'all so afraid to start over. I'm already on my 25th life, you know? And I'm like, yeah, listen, I'll go to the bottom real quick if I think it's going to get me where I want to be, you know? Like, I remember when when the contract was ending, and I had a producer reach out to me. It was like, would you be interested in learning how to produce? And I was like, yeah, I'd be interested. She's like, if you want to do this, you probably won't be writing for a while because this is so busy. And I was like, no, yeah. She's like, and you'll have to start at the bottom. And I was like, yeah, no, that's cool. And so I was coming out of a script coordinator position to go into another coordinator position, which would have been at the bottom. But I know had I done it, I would have learned real quick and taken that and been like, oh, yeah, I'm over at Marvel now. You know, like by now, I probably could have produced, you know, Black Panther or Wakanda, whatever. And so who knows? But I think you just said, yeah, you got to get rid of the ego and really just go for it.
But speaking of films, you know, you have 3 documentaries, and, you know, really guerrilla filmmaking. And there is something to be said about the topics that you chose to focus on and the advocacy work. There's one about rape. There's one about Black mental health. And there's one about Black people finding a safe space outside of the United States that will, you know, treat us as human beings. I would love for you to identify something that caused you to connect or hone in on one of these stories, particularly, like, or if something happened for these stories to be birthed in you in a way, like whether it was something personal within you, something that you kept witnessing, something that you just wanted to really amplify. But you don't just choose the type of subjects that you chose for your films out of nowhere.
Right.
I'd love for you to. Yeah,
it really just started. It was all a path. So it was seeking asylum first, and which, you know, is what made me like the accidental documentary filmmaker, because I hadn't planned on being a documentary filmmaker, hadn't planned on any of that. One day I was just, you know, I told the story a million times, but I was going to Europe for a festival, and I was going to backpack through the continent. And I had my camera, and a friend was like, oh, are you seeking asylum over there? Because Freddie Gray had just been killed in Baltimore by the police. I was like, you know, that's not a bad idea. And so I had my camera. I went around the country, asked a bunch of people questions, came back with tons of footage about, you know, if Black people in America wanted to leave, would you accept us and welcome us with open arms here in this country? I went to about four or five countries. But then I got home with the footage and I'm watching it and I'm putting it in festivals. And then the topic of mental health kept coming up about how we, as Black folks in America, suffer from PTSD, anxiety, depression, because of all these things that have happened. I'm currently writing a piece on Black grief right now. Well, by the time this comes out, you know, it'll be in the Huff Post.
The Huffington Post piece Darnell is speaking of is called Why We Need Black Death Doulas. I ain't even know Fred was a death doula. I'll put the link in the show notes. Goes to show, we just don't know everything about our damn friends.
You know, and so this is what we were dealing with. And so I was like, why aren't we talking about mental health? Maybe I need to talk about that. And so now as like a person who's actually making film, I'm like, let me talk about that. So I talk about that. And then while making that film, what happened was a lot of the people who were coming and talking to me were bringing up how their, you know, the mental illnesses that they were dealing with started because of sexual assault. And I'm like, why are we talking about that? All right, cool. And so I had to talk about that. And I was living in South Africa at the time when I started that project. And I just remember, leaving a friend's bar, like literally a 1-minute walk from my place, and walked by this woman on the ground who had been stabbed. She's bleeding out. There was a trail of blood, you know, all the way around the corner. Like, I followed it back around the corner after the people came and got her. But I'm literally walking by, and I stop, and I'm staring, and I'm like, am I tripping? Because everybody else around was going about their day. Like, there was a fruit guy selling fruit from his basket 5 feet away. People were just people were stepping over. It was like this person was not there, and I thought that I was the only one that saw her until this other woman stopped. And one, I thought she was dead because she wasn't moving. And then the other woman, she bent down. She's like, hey, hey, hey. And I think she tapped her, and she moved, and you could just see, like, stab wounds. And I'm like, what happened? And then I'm like, people are just ignoring this? And it really bothered me, and I was like, this is a story that needs to be told. Cause I remember going back to the bar. Cause when I followed the trail of blood, I walked all the way around the corner and it went past the bar. And I went in the bar and there was some guys sitting in the front where they could have seen her as she walked by. And I was like, hey, did you all see a woman walk by? I just saw a woman just bent over, like, on the ground. I mean, like, I thought she was dead, da da da. They were like, oh yeah, we saw her walk by. I was like, why didn't y'all call the police? They're like, well, she's probably a prostitute or who knows. And I was just like,
wow,
that doesn't mean she doesn't need help, you know? And it was a whole thing. And I was like, we need to talk about assault and how people, there's some people who are just invisible to a lot of folks. And so that kind of pushed it forward. Like, all the mental health film started it, but that was the moment I was like, yeah, I got to make this. And it was tough. It was hard, man. It was hard making that. But it got done eventually. I think it was like 6 months after my original finish date. Cause I was like, I can't finish this. Cause I had to be the one to keep interviewing and keep watching it to make sure I had it. And it was heavy.
And it's interesting, even want to call it spiritually speaking, that when you did one, the first one, the through line was something else that led to the second film, which brought up the connection of the mental health being connected to things that have happened to us. There's just something to be said around the fact that they didn't think she was worthy of protection because of what they thought she was doing for a living, which has nothing to do
with anything,
with her still not needing protection.
Exactly. And it was just like, it was this moment of there, because you hear it, like, as a Black man, I hear it all the time. I see it all the time on Facebook, where Black women are saying, you know, no one's looking out for us. No one's doing, and because that wasn't my experience, I would see it and I'd be like, is this true? Or are y'all just saying this? You know what I mean? For like a while, for like years. Because I never, like, for my friends and for people I knew, I was never the person to just leave them out or not be there when needed. You know what I mean? And so, and other guys I knew. And so when I would read it, I'd be like, oh, they're just saying it. And so then I think over the last few years, it's been these moments of, oh, yeah, this is true. Like, there are men out there that do not care and and are not looking and wouldn't even call, like, would not call the police if they saw you bleeding on the sidewalk. And it was this moment of, wow, you know, like, okay. And so, like, I've never argued with anyone saying, you know, that's not true. I accept everyone's experience. But in my head, I'm like, huh, okay, maybe, yeah. But now I'm like, yeah, you're 100% right.
I am triggered by Black men that qualify me if I'm as far as if I'm worthy of being respected and protected. Mm-hmm. And I think there is a thing around limited capacity based on this ideals of masculinity that some people have been raised to subscribe to, which oftentimes puts Black women in positions to get hurt, to be disregarded, to be disrespected, to be killed on the extreme cases.
Yeah.
So yes, Darnell, you are surrounded and you pour into the Black women that are around you. I mean, I always tie it back to the man's relationship with his mother. Mm-hmm. And so there's more work, I think, sometimes that has to be done beyond you know, beyond repair. If you don't have the best relationship with your mother and you're recognizing your relationships with women are tumultuous, are you willing to do the work to mend that? But speaking of stories and health, I don't know about you, friend, but the end of 2022, I found myself at zero. Mm-hmm. Zero emotional and mental capacity. I fell into isolation. I fell into solitude. I was not answering phone calls. I was not returning phone calls. I was barely even texting people. I didn't want to be around anybody. And I didn't want to name it, Darnell, but it felt very different. Like, I am a loud ambivert. And although people want to box me into being an extrovert, but I get my recharge in solitude. Mm-hmm. And that's where my introverted ways come out, right? Like, I can be out in front of people, but ambivert lifestyle, a balance between the two, is where Georgette lives. And I'm also a recluse, have no problem sitting alone. But this felt different, Darnell. Mm-hmm. This felt very different. And has storytelling ever taken you to some dark places? And if it has, what was it? Mm-hmm. How did you move through it? Or how are you still moving through it?
Yeah, absolutely. Sexual assault documentary. Making that, of course, absolutely went to some very, you know, like, having to watch it over and over. I had friends who were in here. I had friends' mothers who participated. And, you know, listening to these stories, and then I had to watch it over and over to edit it. And then over and over to make sure I had the footage I needed. And it's kind of, you know, as someone, I'm very sensitive to those things. And so watching it over and over, just really, I mean, it was, like I said, it took an extra 6 months, because between interviews, I had to just hide away for like a week and a half. You know, like, I would go to like wherever I could be alone, like you were saying, you know, like, now I have this cabin. I didn't have the cabin at the time, but I don't even know where I was. I was in South Africa. I was sometimes in the States, and I would just find like places that had blackout curtains and no windows, and just sit there and be like, wow, you know. It got like really dark for a while in there. And then it was like, okay, we just got to put this thing out. We really just got to put this thing out. And I hope it's worth it. And thankfully it was. It thankfully it worked out. And I think we were able to save lives. I think we were able to really help people find joy again with the documentary. So it all became worth it. But yeah, it was dark for a long time.
How do you come out of these stories?
Yeah.
That took you to dark places?
For me, honestly, it doesn't stay with me long. I think I have a great support system of just friends who are always ready to just eat and connect and talk and laugh. And so that really pulls me out. So it doesn't stay with me long. It's kind of like a tattoo, you know, like you're getting a tattoo, they're doing it and it hurts, and then they stop and it's like a little tingle, but eventually it just goes away. And so that's what it was. With that project, I was just in it for months and months and months. And it was just like, oh. And so it would take me a week and a half between, because like five of those days, I'm like, huh. And then the last two would be like, okay, I'm with some friends, we're eating, we're chilling, we're kicking it. Now I got to go back into it. Okay, cool. But now I'm able to recharge. Therapy, journaling works a lot. I've always advocated for mental health assistance for everybody, especially Black folks. And so I think I'm fortunate enough. Like, I have friends who I really advocate for with their mental health, and I talk to as often as possible. We reach out and we talk, but they don't. You know, I know how hard it is for some of them to come out of that. And I see how hard it is. And I really consider myself, I don't know if it's lucky or what it is, but it's like, it's not like that for me. And I try to fight that, thankfully. Like, I don't know what I got to do, but I do a lot of self-care. It's like, okay, you know, I feel like the end of 2022, like you said, 2020, that was a long, exhausting, draining year. You know, a lot of goals were achieved, but it was also like, oh my god, like, I just need I need a lot of sleep. And so, but I take a lot of trips. I'll go play. I do a lot of solo trips. I'll hop on a cruise. I'll hop on a boat and be like, I'm on this boat in a room by myself in the middle of the ocean. No Wi-Fi, no phone working. Cool. I'm gonna go ahead and sleep. I'm gonna go ahead and talk to these people that I don't know. But like a lot of self-care and however I can get it. And it's mostly food. I love food. So I love food so much. Like I should absolutely be on my 600-pound life, and it's only by miracle
that you are not 600 pounds. It's all that damn moving around you do though. Think about it. You're always moving around, you know, with your trips and passport required. The way we take care of ourselves is so important. I recently learned that I'm very sensitive to other people's traumas, whether hearing about it or seeing it on the TV screen, which doesn't always make for a great television experience. For me, it started with a group of professionals, including my spiritual mentor, and then later adding a therapist. But you can get the tea about my wellness journey in episode 8. For Darnell, he connected with food and traveling, taking a lot of trips and bringing others with him through his imprint called Passport Required. Mm-hmm. Speaking of Passport Required, what are some of the things that you're proud of? Like the work that you're doing, whether it's storytelling, whether it's the trips, you know, give, you know, talk your shit.
Really proud of that. Like it started as a, I don't even know what I would have even called, like a, I was already traveling and I was just like, you know, I want to take people with me. And so it started as that, as me taking people with me on trips. And then it moved into me taking more people and then people finding out about it and coming. And now it's like this thing that is exactly where I want. Like people are always hitting me up like, yo, we can, I can help you grow this and I can help you make this as big as so-and-so. And I'm like, that's not, I don't want to do that because this is, I still wanted to have this feeling of what it is. And I can't really figure out what it is, but it's like this place where people can come and just be happy. And so I've created this, this place. I've created this amazing place where people can come and get joy and get away from all the stuff that's bringing them down, that exhaustion. And it's like, oh, I can go here and do that. And they do it. And they come and then they go home and they're like, wow, I didn't know I needed that. So that's happening. Like as far as writing, I'm...
Shameless plug, Darnell and I are working on a short film that he wrote that will serve as our proof of concept for a feature film. It'll be my first narrative that I'm producing. I'm so excited.
You know, but then I have, you know, this animated short that I'm working on and learning how to do your job, you know, learning how to produce and learning how to direct short animation. And it's great because with this, I'm able to, I think one of my goals in creating children's television and children's media is to really bring a lot of representation. And so, you know, this is about a kid with a disability. And I know a kid who has this exact same disability, and it's like, you know, him seeing the photos, he's like, oh, that's me. And I'm like, yes, that's, you know, this is what I want to do. And so, you know, even my episode of Karma's World was about a kid with dyslexia. And so I'm really proud that I'm able to show kids themselves outside of themselves on television, and in films. And that, like, that feels really good. Yeah. And just creating these spaces, like, you know, I have this cabin that I'm able to use as an artist residency, and I just got this place in Detroit that I'm able to do also the same whenever I start fixing that up, and it's good. I can come home and see my people and do some work here. Like I'm directing a August Wilson play this year here in Virginia.
Nice.
Yeah, it's cool. It's they're doing the whole lot, and I get to do King Headley, and so I'm excited about that. Yeah, it's dope. It's dope stuff happening. So I'm proud of all of it.
Yeah, no, I believe in you, friend. That's why I'm like, sometimes I don't have capacity for all the things that Darnell wants to assign me to, but I believe in you and the work that you're doing and definitely want to jump in when projects feel aligned. Yeah, I'm proud of you. Congrats. Well-deserved.
I think we're both, like, you've always been doing your thing. You know what I'm saying? So, I'd be like,
but similar to what you said earlier, you don't feel like you're in it. You'd be working. You don't feel like you don't feel like similar to what you said earlier. I don't always feel like I'm like anything's moving, right? Like it just sometimes feels like I'm not in it.
Yeah. And it's crazy. Like there's the book, one of my favorite memoirs. I love memoirs, and called My Soul Looks Back by Jessica B. Harris. And it's about her relationship with this guy who was in the, in circle with, you know, Baldwin, Nina Simone, Maya Angelou, like that circle. She was about 20 years younger than everyone. And, you know, she's going out, hanging out and all this stuff. But she always said how she felt like this outsider, even when she was in. And it took a long time for her to realize, oh, I guess. Yeah. Okay. I guess I was there. And so, but I, you know, I think that's the thing. Like, I was at the Emmy party, you know, like in the gala with these folks who were also nominated, some who won. And I'm in there like, I just did not belong. I was like, what? Why? How did, yeah, I felt like I was a plus one, you know? And I'm talking to this photographer and who she shoots like the Gettys and all this stuff. And she's like, wow, you know, so what did you do? And I'm telling her all the stuff. She's like, oh, so these are your people. And I was just like, yeah, I guess so. You're right. And I needed to hear that. And I probably got to hear it like 100 more times for it to actually stick. But, you know, we are in it. And I mean, you got the Emmy in the next room, you know, so.
And there is a lot of imposter syndrome around that. Mm-hmm.
Oh, no, but even that, same. Like, because even I remember getting the call from my friend Anthony Anderson. Not the Anthony Anderson. It's two Anthony Andersons. He's the other Anthony Anderson. Because then people be like, oh, you know Anthony Anderson? Not Blackish Anthony Anderson, Anacostia Anthony Anderson. Just as important. But he called me. He was like, I'm asleep. He's like, wake up. You just got an Emmy nomination. And I'm like, what? He's like, yeah. He's like, Karma's where I just got. I was like, is my name on it? Because I know, like, politics of TV could be strange. And so I'm like, is my name on it? And he's like, no, ain't no names on it. I know you work for the show. And I was like, yeah, I don't know. And so literally for like 2 weeks, I think, I was just walking around like, yeah, I'm not talking about that. we not bringing that up because I don't know. And then he called me again. I was in Jamaica and he calls. He's like, your name on the paper. And I was like, What paper? He's like, Carver's World. I'm like, oh my God. Okay, but does that mean, and still, it was like.
You had questions.
Right, like even promoting myself with it. You know, now, because I'm always on, you know, everywhere, social media, LinkedIn, everywhere. And I'm always just talking about me as a writer. And people see that, oh, you got nominated for Carver's World. So people always want to talk about that. And it's like, and I love it. I do love talking about it, but it's still like, yeah, I don't know if I want to talk about the work. You know, because it's real. It's real. Imposter syndrome is real. But we did it. We are here. And so now I fight against that by just going even harder, even when I'm uncomfortable doing it. You know, even saying like, oh, okay, here's my Wikipedia. Here's this. And trying to stay somewhere between like who I was and Kanye West. So somewhere in the middle, you know, it's like.
Because Kanye is very extreme. The Kanye
so it's like,
mentality is very extreme.
Like Darnell Kanye.
On how he loves himself.
Somewhere right here.
I respect that range. Somewhere between who you were and Kanye West. That's all right.
Yeah.
Because Kanye loves Kanye.
Kanye loves Kanye. And, you know, like maybe, you know. You know, a little after College Dropout, what was the second album? That Kanye, you know.
Yes.
Or what's that one song? I put on, like I put on Kanye. You know, like around there. You know.
That's hilarious. Yeah, you know, it's funny how you found out about your Emmy nomination. I literally had taken an $80,000 pay cut. I was literally in the radio station at 99 Jams in Miami. My former coworker from Nickelodeon texts me. He said, Georgia, you got an Emmy nomination. I said, for what? I literally was like, for what? He texts me the screenshot. I was like, this shit was released a year ago. I was like, this got nominated and we won. Darnell, that was not on my bucket list of anything. Like, yeah, it wasn't.
That's what
on
I'm
my
saying.
List of
right. And you see,
it wasn't on my list.
And it's, like I said, it's one of those things that just, it's really like you're going along, like you're moving along through space.
Yep.
And then one day, miraculously something happens and you're like, oh, that happened. Like I promise you, like even I remember Emmy weekend And I'm riding through LA, and I passed my old apartment.
And your weekend was, to clarify, because there's different
Emmys. Oh, so many Emmys. Yours, yeah, but... This was the first year. So this is the first year that they did the Children of Families Emmys, because we used to be mixed in with daytime, and it was like, why is Blue's Clues going up against Days of Our Lives? Like, what's, you know, so it's like, what's happening?
And y'all are in December. That was in December.
December, yeah. So December 10th-ish week, whatever that weekend was. But I remember passing my old apartment on Adams and Arlington in LA, and I'm like, man, like, I remember being in this apartment thinking, like, this will never happen for me. You know, I had, you know, of course you have friends, they got put on, you know, I'm at parties, what, 10 years ago. Yeah, 10 years ago, working at a job I thought could get me in the door in casting at a major network, and I hated it. But hanging with people who, you know, one who just got put on Empire, one whose career was like literally just kicking off, who later went on to do like really big things. And I'm sitting there like, okay, I guess it's happening for everybody else. And then one day when you get to take a break, you look back and you're like, oh, yeah, I guess that did happen for me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I feel that. Yeah, it's just still digesting it. It took me 2 years to actually put the Emmy on display. And so I hope you printed out that picture when you had the Emmy in your hand in my apartment.
I got all those pictures. I got the
to one. Manifest.
And you know, I told you my goal is to take, so when I do win my Emmy, me and you have to go to like Waffle House or like the shadiest, the sketchiest restaurant and just put it on the table while we eat. And get that photo.
I'm down with that. I'm not a Waffle House gal, but matter. We can go somewhere.
Yep. It would have been Kitchen 24, like 3-6 Mafia.
They closed it. That's my shit.
But I think they closed, right? Didn't they?
They did close it. They closed the one down in Hollywood. That's the one in I Hollywood, knew. And I know, yeah. There was one in West Hollywood. Yeah. Life has a way of interrupting the vision we have for ourselves. Tell me a time where you literally had a what the fuck just happened moment. A moment that caused you to course correct personally or professionally.
Speaking of the job that I hated, in LA that I just mentioned, I took it. It was in casting, and there were some great people. Like, I met an amazing friend of mine, Felicia, there. But overall, like, the company was just bad, right? And the vibes were bad, and I was just treated so poorly. And I remember there was one day when the management had kind of switched up. Felicia left and went on to do bigger and better things midway through our season. And or through my contract. And so it changed up a bit. And they put this other woman in charge who one day comes and she's like, hey, Darnell, I gave you, she said, remember the other day when I gave you the two checks to go cash? What'd you do with the second one? I was like, you gave me one check. She's like, no, I'm pretty sure I gave you two. I was like, no, I'm pretty sure you gave me one. And I cashed it and I brought the money back. She's like, no, I think I gave you two. What'd you do with that money? And I was like, well, I need you to say what I think you're trying to say, because it sounds like you're trying to say something. And I need you to just say that so I can know how to respond. And this is my boss, right? And she's like, I'm not trying to say anything. I was like, all right, well, I ain't got the check. Okay, well, I'll just call the bank tomorrow and ask them if it's been cashed. And I was like, okay. And she walked over to her desk and found that check inside of her desk, right? Like literally 5 minutes later. So that happened. We move on. And I'm talking to Felicia. Felicia at her new job. I'm like, Felicia, this is not working out. She's like, you know, just, you only got a week and a half left. Just ride it out. Your contract will be done. You know, you all still got to work together. Just get it done. And I'm like, cool. Monday rolls around. No. Thursday. Because our big day was a Friday. Thursday comes and something happened with an order for food that one of the assistants wasn't able to get. And so I was just above an assistant, right? Like, I was a coordinator there. I was a casting coordinator. And so here she comes. Darnell, you make an excuse. Just going off for like 5 minutes. You make an excuse for everything. You're this and this and da-da-da and I just don't understand how you don't understand this and blah, 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 blah. And I'm sitting there listening as I do, because I need to take it all in, just real calm.
And I mean, it's like everybody standing around, all my actors, my two bosses, couple of assistants. It's like 20 people there. And she stops after about 5 minutes. And I was like, okay, cool. I said, are you done? It was like the M'Baku.
Are you done? Are you done?
Are you done?
And I wish that movie had come out by then, at that point, because that's exactly what I would have asked. Are you done? But I was like, are you finished? She's like, mm-hmm. I said, don't you ever in your life speak to me again. I said, you are never allowed to speak to me. I said, don't open your mouth to me. Don't look in my direction. Never speak to me again. You are an ineffective leader. You are a horrible person. You are a horrible boss. I was like, I tried to do this job. I've done everything I needed to do. I told you what happened. Everything I said was true. You tried to accuse me of stealing money. You are a horrible person. I said, and if you ever talk to me again, we'll have issues. And the other boss, she's like, Darnell, you can't talk to her that way. I was like, why not? She's your boss. And my hand went up like I was about to, on its own, it just went up and I caught it. And I was like, oh, and I just put it over my mouth. And I was like, how about neither of you fucking talk to me? How about that? I was like, I'm going to go back to this office. We have 1 week left. We have the showcase tomorrow. We're going to get it done. It's going to be amazing. Next week, I have no work, but I'm going to come in. We're going to do our job. We're not going to speak. Y'all have a good night. And I went back to the office. They came back and they were like, Darnell, you know, you did such a great job with this flyer. I was like, mm-mm. Put it in an email. And that was the last time we spoke. We had our workshop, our showcase. It was fine. That Monday rolled around. I literally had no more work to do, but I would just come in just so I can get the hours. Friday came. I took my badge off at like noon. And I was like, listen, I'm not going to sit here till 6 o'clock. I have nothing left to do. This is my last day. Here's my badge. And they were like, oh, no, no, please, please don't leave yet. We're having a surprise going away party for you. I was like, y'all can eat that fucking cake. And walked out. And it was this moment where I was like, oh, no one's going to treat me this way in any circumstances, but definitely not Hollywood. If it's not, especially for a job I don't want. Like, I didn't want to be in casting. It was a job I took just so I can have a foot in. And then I just, like, I was offered jobs after that, and I just couldn't do it because it was like, I don't trust. It took a while. Like, it was like, I don't trust y'all. And it was like this moment of understanding how Hollywood was, and which was crazy because then, you know, that was 2013. 26 years later, I get this job at Blue's Clues, and everyone in the kids' space they're very different. Everyone's very different. And I remember walking around and I'm like, these people are so nice. And I'm just waiting for that other foot to drop, you know, like, and then I understood abusive relationships because I was like, oh, because I'm walking around like, at any moment, someone's going to attack me. And then at some point, someone was like, you know, you don't say much. I was like, yeah, because I'm waiting for one of y'all to just cut somebody out. And they were like, we don't do that here. And I was like, oh, yo, they really messed me up out there. But that was that moment. And I was like, yeah, no, I can't have that. And it's funny because I still have the letter. And I went I wrote this long letter, 4 or 5 pages, that I turned into one of the VPs over at that company. And I was like, listen, I don't want to. He was like, do you want to file this with HR? I was like, no. Because I don't want anybody to blackball me anywhere. I was like, I don't know how that works. I was like, but I just want you to have it in case anyone tries to say anything about what happened. You have this letter if it needs to be used at a later time. And I found it actually in my email a couple of months ago. And I looked up one of the women, the one I cussed out first, the one that accused me of money, and saw that she adopted a black child. And I was like, I ought to call her out.
Oh, no.
But yep, so that's my story. That's my story.
PTSD in the workforce for Black people, especially in white corporate spaces, I'm assuming your space was a white corporate space. Mm-hmm. It's loud. And I am always thinking about that when I move around. I think we think about more things than the average non-Black person has to think about. So listen, I get into all of this in episode 5 with Amadi Pate and Stephen Williams. Navigating white corporate spaces for Black and brown people just hits different. What would have been the title of your story before your life interrupted moment
Like, it would be something like his mother's child, right? Because my mom was like that, too. My mom, like, I got that from my mom. You know, like, she ain't play no games. You know, I remember being in school as a kid, and she had a very similar conversation with one of my teachers who probably is still afraid to speak to me if she saw me in public. But, yeah, like, it's something like you, maybe you will be remembered. You will be remembered. I like that.
What would it be now?
It'd be like, don't fuck with Darnell, though. you know, because like for real, like I think me, I established early in my jobs what you aren't going to do because I've seen people, like I've never needed a job. Like I've never been somewhere and I'm like, I need to be here. And so I'll be quick to be like, all right, yeah, I'm gonna go ahead and correct this situation now. So even being at that job, like having those conversations with them wasn't a hard thing to do. It was like, well, if you fire me, cool. I will find another job, but y'all not gonna talk to me like y'all talk to these other people. And it's so funny because I went on LinkedIn the other day to find one of the guys who worked in the office where I was. He was an assistant at the time, and his boss, I mean, the way he used to talk to him, I was like, dude, this is why people come to work loaded. Yeah, because there is no way. And I used to ask him like, you gonna let him talk to you like that? And he's like, you know, this is just how people are. I won't be in here for long. And I'm like, yeah, okay. And now he's one of the higher ups. He's one of the executives. And I'm like, I hope he's not treating people. And I would love to go and see if he's treating people that way to remind him of where he came from. Because no one should treat anyone that way.
His mama's child and nobody's fool, nope. AKA don't fuck with Darnell.
Don't fuck with Darnell.
The memoir. I love it.
Lifetime store.
Darnell, thank you. It's always a pleasure chopping it up with you in this way. You are everywhere on social. Please tell the good people how to find you, which will also be in the show notes.
Yeah, you can find me with my blue check mark, son, on Instagram.
For full transparency, Darnell's blue check was before the Meta Verified subscription plan, where blue checks are now up for sale like Twitter.
On Instagram is hello.darnell because somebody did whatever they did. So hello.darnell, and then Twitter, hello.darnell, Facebook, Darnell Lamont Walker, LinkedIn, Darnell Lamont Walker. Find me.
I love it. You're not doing Substack or anything like that yet.
No, I do want to get a Substack. I'm not consistent enough to have Substack.
Yeah. And then you have a website.
DarnellWalker.com.
Darnell and I could chop all day about life because that's just who he is if you're ever so gracious to cross paths with him. As an artist, you essentially get it how you live. No, literally. There's nothing else you'd rather do except for the thing that pulls at your heartstrings. And even then, you're still hurt by the artist that lives within you. But you know the world needs to see your thing, read your thing, experience your thing, or witness your thing, whatever your thing is. In my late 30s, I found myself pivoting to pursue writing professionally in a way that I didn't think to try before. Even when the writings were on the wall of that younger Georgette behind the typewriter, or the high school Georgette who wrote a poem that made her friend cry, or Brown Skin, my rapper moniker in college that had everyone going, I know you feeling me right. If you know, you know. The pivot at this age probably contributed to me falling into a dark place a few months ago. It scared the shit out of me. I had questions, but what I was reminded of in this conversation and this entire season was the arbitrary timelines, the arbitrary pressures I put on myself didn't even come close as a measurement to the life I'm supposed to live. If you're still figuring that out at 16, 22, 38, or in your 40s and 50s, cheers to you because you still get a chance to figure it out. My artist journey is nowhere close to where I think I should be, but thank God and my highest resonating ancestors that it's not just up to me to decide. The quiet observers on the side that chime in and hold on a little bit longer because they saw how I have makes this non-linear journey even more worthwhile. So to all my artists, creatives, non-creatives, human beings on the path to figuring themselves out, the kid's gonna be all right. And we are the kids that I'm speaking of. Thanks for listening, truly. The way I approached this season stretched me, boy. But it was the best way to share the stories I needed to tell. Until the next season, perhaps. And that's a motherfucking wrap on season 4. Peace. This podcast was written and hosted by me, Georgette Pierre, associate producer Tristan Bragg, and co-producer and editor Wise Grisette for the Indie Creative Network. Music by Otis McDonald, King Canyon, and Bail Bonds. You can follow my conversations on Twitter at Georgette and Instagram at Georgette Pierre. That's GeorgettePierre. You can follow the podcast on Twitter and Instagram at Black Nuance Pod. That's Black, NuancePod, or email us at blacknuancepod@gmail.com, spelled the same exact way. Subscribe and share from your favorite podcast app. We're streaming on Apple, Spotify, Google, Amazon, and more. Thanks for listening.